Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. I am Rob Crowther at the Center in Seattle, and joining me today is Scott Turner. He is a professor of biology at the State University of New York College of Environmental Sciences and Forestry, also a visiting scholar at Cambridge University, and really came to fame in science circles with his first two books, one on why animals build things, the extended organism, and the other, The Tinkerer's Accomplice, focusing on the problem of design in biology. Besides being a professor, teaching, doing research, he's a biologist, a physiologist, and obviously isn't afraid to broach some difficult and maybe at times professionally dangerous ideas. He argues that modern Darwinism has become a scientific dead end, ultimately unable to tell us what life is. And that brings us to his latest book, which we'll talk about today. It's called Purpose and Desire, What Makes Something Alive and Why Modern Darwinism Has Failed to Explain It. It's published by HarperCollins, and that is definitely a provocative, maybe controversial title. Welcome, Scott, to ID the Future. And maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Hi, Rob. Delighted to be here. And yes, let's have a chat.
Okay. So your title is a little bit provocative. Why don't you tell us in a nutshell what is provocative about the book and the argument that you're making in it?
Well, Purpose and Desire, the title, is meant as a counter to the title of another very influential book published in the 1970s by the molecular biologist Jacques Monod, a very deep thinker and really wonderful writer. And the title of his book was Chance and Necessity. And among the things that was in Chance and Necessity was this notion that, you know, you have to treat what I come to view as obviously very important and distinguishing features of life as if they were almost illusions, you know. So one of the arguments that I make in the book is that life is very purposeful, and that's where the purpose part comes from. It's not chance. And also that life exerts a great deal of choice and novelty in the way it manages to live, and that's the counterfoil to the necessity part of Jacques Monod's book. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is try to refocus our thinking on what really is it that makes life distinctive. And, you know, the prevailing viewpoint of life as being something that's governed by mechanisms, and that there's a great deal of chance involved in making life what it is, really misses the point of what life actually is, which is it's a purposeful phenomenon. That's the thing that makes it very distinctive about life. It's an intentional phenomenon. And so that's the basic message that I'm trying to lay out in the book. And the chance and necessity part, I think, has led us into a kind of a scientific dead end. I don't want to entirely say that because, you know, modern biology is truly a wonder to behold. You know, we've learned a great deal about life by treating it as a mechanism and trying to burrow right down to the uttermost details of how life works. But ultimately, it has left biology in a position where it's unable to define what our subject is, namely life. We tend to study life as a sub-branch of physics or a sub-branch of chemistry, and that means that you really can't define something as distinctively life, and that's I think that's something that has really led us into a philosophical pickle, if you will.
Right. Now, when you talk about life and things being alive, is there an accepted definition by consensus for what life is and what makes something alive? How do we know something is alive?
Well, this is the dilemma. You know, if you get a group of students in a room and you ask them what makes a cauliflower alive, you'll get a variety of answers. It has genes. It reproduces. It has a particular form. All those kinds of things. And that's an example of how deeply the mechanistic and materialist approach to life has permeated our thinking and our teaching about life. you know, when you look at, for example, the definition of life as having genes, right? And so did these genes just miraculously appear? And the evidence which has been made, the case has been made very, very strongly by people like Steve Meyer and others, is that no, you can't just have a gene appearing out of nowhere. You know, when you start getting into that, you start having to indulge in miraculous thinking. And in the case of genes, you know, our current understanding of genes had to have come from somewhere. And probably there was a period in the evolution of life where there were no genes. And so this means that, you know, defining life as having genes really doesn't get you to the nub of the matter, you know. And you can make the same argument for reproduction. You know, reproduction is a very complicated and sophisticated process. Did it just come from nowhere? Clearly it didn't. Statistically, it's highly improbable, almost impossible, I would say. So those kinds of common definitions really kind of fall away under any kind of logical argument. And ultimately what you come down to is that what really makes something alive is you have this intentional phenomenon. That's really what distinguishes it. It's an intentional cognitive agents that actually are at the heart of life. And when you start talking about cognition and intentionality and purpose and those kinds of things, then, you know, it starts getting into some uncomfortable territory for modern biology, which is so strongly invested in the notion that no, you can have purpose. You know, you have to either call it apparent purpose or bracket it with scare quotes to say that you're not really talking about what you are saying you're talking about. And I think that's indicative of the rampant confusion that actually permeates modern biology, often unacknowledged confusion, and the consequences that you have incoherency just permeating all through modern biology, because we're not looking at biology, life, as the unique phenomenon that it is. And the things that make it unique are intentionality and purposefulness and agents that are aware of what their environment is and how to purposefully modify it to persist as living things. And so, yeah.
Yeah, so you talk a lot in the book about intention and cognition, and then the book is titled Purpose and Desire. And I'm wondering if you can sort of explain how those things fit together, because what I'm hearing a little bit, I think, is that there is some intention within nature, and that would seem to relate to the purpose side, maybe. Is that right?
Yeah. Certainly purpose exists in living nature. And, you know, as I mentioned, that's the kind of dirty secret amongst modern biologists, you know, that it's there. Everyone acknowledges that it's there, but not always explicitly, you know, but still we carry on with our studies of biology as phenomena of chemistry and molecular biology and those kinds of things. And as I said, the dividing line between life and non-life then becomes quite blurry, and it's hard to distinguish that. And the argument that I make in the book is that what distinguishes life is it has agency. It has purposeful agency. Life knows what its environment is and can take purposeful steps to actually persist in that environment. And when you look into life in that way, you are inevitably led to the conclusion that first of all, life has to be cognitive. It has to be aware of its surroundings. It has to be able to map that cognitive picture of the environment into some modification of what's going on inside cells or organisms. And then it's connected to the ability to do work on an environment to modify it in such a way that makes the environment suitable for the organism. And this extends all the way through life. We tend to think of cognition as being the sole province of creatures with complex brains and complex sensory organs like ourselves and maybe other mammals and those kinds of creatures. And we tend to imagine that cognition kind of disappears when you get to simpler kinds of life forms. But what I'm saying is that no, it extends all the way down to everything that's living. You know, if you think about what a bacterium does, for example, and how it lives with other bacteria and how it lives within its environment, you simply cannot escape the notion that those bacteria are aware of their surroundings and they're capable of actually taking action to be able to modify those surroundings so that they can continue to live there. And so, you know, we're really talking about a kind of universal cognition amongst everything that's living.
So trying to track this both in the big picture, higher order things, and then the little picture, the small order things, I'm fascinated by how you describe these organisms that work together, cooperating, you know, on the microscopic level, the molecular machines, and makes me think of like, it might be too cutesy of an image, a Pixar movie of little sentient molecular machines, a work crew, and they're all doing their jobs. There's a bit of machine-like precision to it and also a little bit mechanistic, but you're adding in the intention and cognition of what's going on, even at that small, like minute level.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's chemistry going on in living things. You know, no one would deny that. And there's no doubt that life lives in a physical world, and you know, life needs to pay attention to the constraints of that physical world. But when you're talking about trying to distinguish life from machines, you know, then you have to have some additional agency in there, and that agency is the intentionality and the cognition of living things. You know, you can build a computer that does amazing things and seems to be really, really smart, and you know, that's the whole basis of artificial intelligence, of course. But you know, can a machine really be said to be alive? And my argument is that no, it cannot. It cannot be alive because it doesn't have agency. It can compute, but it doesn't really want to compute. And that's the big difference between say, brains that live in our heads and brains right. that live in our desktops and our computers.
So it sounds like there's a level of constant interaction and adaptation. You talk about the environment that our bodies as complex machines are in. And are they, you know, these inner workings of the cell, the body itself, it's always adapting to its current environment. So all these various systems inside are, you know, constantly changing in order to make sure that we go on as efficiently and effectively as possible.
Yes, it has to, you know, because one of the characteristics of living systems is that they're very highly ordered. You know, they're very complex machines. That's another way of saying that they have a great deal of order to them. And that order is very transient. It's a very precarious state. And so living things have to do work continuously to be able to sustain that order in the face of basically a continual breakdown. And the most obvious example of that is what happens when we die. You know, when we die, we're no longer doing the work to sustain our orderliness. And of course, the consequence is that we very quickly degrade into disorder. So just the fact that life has to be continually doing work to be able to sustain this very precarious and transient orderliness means that it's always paying attention to the environment. It's always responding to the environment. It's always modifying the environment to help sustain that quite precarious orderly state.
It's interesting because it strikes me a little bit like the body is doing fine-tuning. If you think about, you know, the fine-tuning argument that the universe and nature, the laws and physics, you know, are so finely tuned to be so precise that life can exist. And it sounds a little bit like it's that way sort of for ourselves as well, that it's so precise and configured in such a way to make us be able to go on. And that it has to be a little bit more than just, you know, kind of the matter and the meat, so to speak, that's doing it.
Absolutely. You know, the orderliness that we have contained even within the simplest cell is so complex and so finely tuned, if you will, that to its own functioning and to interacting with the environment, that when you consider the ways that something that complex can go wrong, it's really borders on the miraculous that it actually it can be sustained, you know, given the number of ways that a cell, the workings of a cell, can fail or break down, and nevertheless the workings of the cell do persist, and the cell persists in time, even though it's a very highly precariously ordered system. And this is where the cognitive dimension of life starts to come in, you know, because it's a continual race to help maintain that order, and there's no way that it can be done without some awareness of what's happening in the external environment, how to manage the ways that matter and energy flow between cells, and to be able to do work on the environment, to be able to sustain those phenomena. And so, yeah, if you want to compare it to an anthropic principle for the universe, you know, that might very well be a good analogy with of course the proviso that in the case of life, you know, there is this very definite cognitive intentional dimension to it. And of course we can get into philosophical issues about, you know, just how far does that intentionality extend, you know, does it extend to the universe itself.
Yeah, this brings up the a criticism I saw of people saying you're basically arguing for vitalism, or, you know, something like that. They throw that term around a little bit because it's, you know, been debunked so long ago and so on, that they think that that will just sort of sideline your argument. How do you respond to this about what vitalism is and you know, your view in this book being compared to that?
That's an interesting criticism, because it's one of the many ways that we try to evade in modern science the obvious thing about life, namely that it's intentional. And vitalism is one of those examples. For example, vitalism has been construed to be a belief in some, you know, mystical spirit or something like that animates life, and that was certainly the case back in the, you know, the 17th and the up to the late 18th century or so. But vitalism as a mode of thought really changed dramatically in the 19th century. And one of the people that was behind that was a French physiologist, Claude Bernard, who was at the heart of the book. And one of the things about that is he was a vitalist, but he wasn't a vitalist that thought that there were magic spirits animating things. He was a vitalist because he believed very strongly that life was a distinctive phenomenon unlike anything else in the universe. And that kind of vitalistic philosophy is actually a very productive philosophy. You know, Claude Bernard was regarded as the founder of experimental physiology, and rightly so. He was a brilliant biologist, but his form of vitalism was simply that let's acknowledge that life is distinctive. It's not just chemistry, and it's not just physics. It's really something that goes beyond that. And when you look at the book, I've actually made the case that it's time for us to acknowledge that, yes, life is distinctive, and there may be rules that apply to its study that don't apply simply to chemistry and physics. And so, yes, I am a vitalist, but the criticism really come from this kind of straw man vitalism that has been embedded in our thinking. You know, there are multiple ways to think about vitalism, and some of them are perfectly scientifically respectable. And you see the same thing. You know, one of the things I try to do in the book is to take a much derided figure in evolutionary thought, namely Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck, and you know, he is usually held up as an object of ridicule in modern Darwinian circles. And he's an object of ridicule only because, you know, we've really distorted the history of Lamarckian thought and how it relates to Darwinism and the relationship between Charles Darwin and Lamarck's thinking. And this kind of distortion really permeates through modern biology, and it really makes, I think, rational debate about evolution very difficult in the public sphere. And, you know, because you can always trot out the straw man, and this is done quite often. And when you delve into, you know, how people actually thought, what they actually wrote, then you find it's actually much more complex and nuanced than you know the critics would have. So to the critics, all I can say is, all right, well, read the book. You know, I think you'll find that there are surprises in there that go beyond this kind of shallow criticism.
Yeah, you sort of talk in the book about a Hobson's choice, a take it or leave it approach. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, you know, when you're training to be a biologist, you know, you're embedded in this culture, and when you're a science graduate student or a student, for example, you know, you're taught that there is one particular way to think about life and to think about evolution in particular, and if you stray from that, you cannot be a scientist. And so, you have a choice. You know, you can either acknowledge what life's distinctive properties are, namely that it's purposeful, that it's intentional, in which case you can't be a scientist anymore. But in order to be a scientist of life, you have to deny the very things that make life distinctive. And you know that's obviously a very difficult choice, and it's, I think, kind of a false choice. But nevertheless, that's the Hobson's choice that I wrote about in the book, and it's held in place by a lot of these stories about what Darwin supposedly thought, what Lamarck supposedly thought, what vitalism is, what teleology and purposefulness is, and these sorts of things. And I'm hoping that maybe one thing that comes out of the book is to maybe take that Hobson's choice away or to invalidate it, because I don't think it's necessary to think scientifically and intelligently about life and evolution.
Mm-hmm. If scientists were to sort of embrace that view again and let purpose and desire back into the discussion as part of how they, you know, look at life and do their research and so on, what would the implications for kind of the overall debate, the whole, you know, Darwin versus design type debate, what would the implications be if that viewpoint started to change?
I hope it would lead to a more honest and actually fruitful discussion about what drives the phenomenon of evolution and what's behind it. And right now, there's the public face of evolutionism is set by thinkers like Richard Dawkins and Will Provine and some of the others that I quoted in the beginning chapters or the beginning paragraphs of the book. And they're very stridently materialist and mechanistic in origin. And the picture they paint of the world is just incredibly bleak. You know, there's no purpose, there's no intelligence, it's all kind of meaningless chemistry and so forth. And that's been, I think, a very destructive aspect of the public debate over evolution, but I think it's also hurt the scientific discussion about evolution as well, in part because it's one of these mechanisms that enforces the Hobson's choice that I mentioned. Now, having said that, you know, I have a lot of colleagues, a lot of scientific colleagues, very highly respected scientific colleagues who have read the book and acknowledge that, yes, you know, of course life is intentional and life is purposeful and all these sorts of things. But when it comes to talking about that in public, that becomes, you know, problematic. People tend to not discuss it. And so, you know, one thing that I hope would happen is that it would become respectable again to become a vitalist, you know, to really acknowledge that the thing that we're all studying, namely life, really is something unique. It's not just chemistry and physics. And I'm finding a growing willingness amongst my scientific colleagues to actually grapple with this and to think about that, take it seriously. So it is good, but, you know, we still have this kind of very constrained public view of what evolution is, in some senses a very constrained view among students and scientists. And so we're by no means out of the woods on that. But, you know, I think there are trends going on that are moving towards, I think, a more constructive way of thinking about evolution rather than the simple mechanistic Darwinian idea that prevails today.
Yeah. Well, I certainly hope so. And your book does a lot to help with that. Purpose and Desire, it's been described as an appeal to widen our perspective of biology and to help bridge the ideological evolutionary divide. So if you're getting engagement from people, you know, that you work with other scientists and so on the issue in a thoughtful way, then you've taken a big step in that direction. I think that's great.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, Purpose and Desire. It's by Scott Turner. This is a provocative book. Definitely something you'll want to read and consider if you're interested in the overall debates about evolution and the origin of life and all of that. You can get it at Amazon.com. We'll have a link to that on our page for this episode of ID the Future. And Scott, I want to thank you for being with us and taking the time to talk about the book.
Thanks so much, Rob. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you very much. For ID the Future and the Center for Science and Culture, I'm Robert Crowther. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.